extra time is exactly how I find out what's going on in the MLS.
Get lost. Get lost.
Maybe this podcast has influenced me a little bit as well.
Everybody up here, every single day, goes into the office, into the laboratory, to try to cook up some great stuff for you guys.
That's why he's here!
From New York, New York, driven by Continental, this is Extra Time. You are welcome, Matt Doyle. It is back because we have no Andrew Wiebe. We will get to that in just a minute. We've got another huge show coming up. I am very excited. For the first time ever, we're having Julia Poe on from the Orlando Sentinel to get us all the info on Pato, on Daryl DK, on what's going on in Orlando, which is basically every single soccer game. And Julia has attended. And we're also going to hit the stuff you want to hear about. Big players in Europe, other transfer moves that need to be made by MLS teams. Could we see an American win the UEFA Champions League this year? Is one we're going to get into in USMNT depth charts. Do not forget, besides this show, you have some must read, must listens. The call up has Greg Fanny coming up later today. And then if you go to MLSsoccer.com, you can read our own Matt Doyle. He's got his USMNT depth charts. Now he's got USU-23s as we are about a month away from Olympic qualifying. And of course, Greg Seltzer on who needs to have a big turnaround in 2021. Hint, Chicharito.
Chicharito is the number one on that list, has to be Chicharito.
It's a nice article where he just writes Chicharito 15 times and then gives reasons why. But your number one listening, obviously, is Extra Time. And it's not just you. It's the players on the field who know that this show is your number one source for MLS. Producer Anders, reminder of the day is that we are a big deal in Scandinavia and in South Korea, as Bjorn Jansson, the new signing for Montreal Impact, said this on his time coming into MLS.
Playing well and doing better every year and getting better players every year. And, you know, I obviously follow as well. So, you know, small things like MLS is back and you know, Extra Time, I watch those podcasts. I follow the MLS.
Not only does he listen, he watches on YouTube. You know he's in the comment section. You know he has a fake ID. He's probably one asking all these questions about Montreal striker situation in the mailbag. I have one thing to say. Thierry Henry, talk to your center forward. You need to come on this show because this is your source for MLS.
Let me ask you this. If you were there during that, you know, Zoom press conference.
Yeah.
And you were called on to ask a question. Would you have asked him who his favorite Extra Time personality is?
No, I would have said, what would be your intro to Extra Time now that Andrew Wiebe has moved to Kansas City? How would you begin the show? And you know he's thought about it.
Yeah, that's true. But did we tell everybody why Wiebe's not on?
Well, we got New York back. That was the key. Okay. So we cut Andrew Wiebe.
Yes.
For everyone out there who doesn't know, which means you don't have any person that you're close to who lives in the South at all. It's really cold and it's snowing.
Central.
Yeah. Anywhere basically south of the North. It's cold and it's snowing and they're all very worried about it. And a lot of people have lost power and ice and all that. So our best wishes go out to anyone like that. Also, people who are really snarky about the weather all the time. Less of our best wishes go out to them. Some still.
Stop. Best wishes to everyone. There are rolling blackouts across half the country. They hit Wiebe's this morning, but he will be back for Thursday's show.
I really like hosting the show, so I will have to pay Bump out him. Because I'm not going to lie. There's no rolling blackouts in Wiebe's neighborhood. I just wanted to host the show, so I cut off his power. I knew we'd have Julia on. I didn't want to waste time with Wiebe's bad Kansas questions because she's a Kansan as well. So I figured it would make it a lot better if we didn't have him. So we do not, but we appreciate Andrew in our hearts and we know that he'll be listening, maybe even watching on YouTube, maybe along with all of the Montreal Impact players CF Montreal.
CF Montreal. Yeah.
Club de Foot, Montreal. All right. So speaking of Montreal, a lot of transfers for them. A lot of unexpected moves, right? Some names we weren't really expecting across the world. From Nigeria, from Korea, all those places. Transfer window about to open up. Obviously, the European one has closed. There are still some in South America and Central America. We've gotten this question left, right, and central. So let's start with this. What is the team that needs to do the most in your mind, Doyle, in this transfer window?
It's NYCFC. And I know this is weird because if you look at what Cincinnati have on their plate and what, you know, RSL maybe have on their plate in terms of getting back to relevance. It's more. But NYCFC had this window of contention for like the last 5 years. They have been one of the best teams in the league. And a lot of that has revolved around identifying guys like Anton Tinnerholm and Alex Ring. A lot of that has revolved around getting productivity from young players. Like when they brought in Ronald Monterita, he was very young. James Sands has developed nicely. A couple other guys checked that box as well. But it feels like that window closed last year because a lot of it also revolved around Maxi Morales. And Maxi Morales was, he had one of the great years that any number 10 has ever had back in 2019. In 2020, he started to show his age. He started to look older. He just started to be hurt more often and less effective on the field. There's no backup for Maxi Morales. And there was no replacement for Alexandre Mitrica when he was loaned out on what looks to be a permanent move over to the Middle East. You know, guys have had, like, the reinforcements have not arrived. And we're all kind of waiting for that to happen because it's City Football Group. Mm-hmm. It's one of the, you know, it's one of the biggest soccer entities in the entire world. And it just hasn't happened yet. And I have their transactions open. They have only officially signed one player this offseason, and it's a homegrown winger. Now, it looks like they're about to get a young backup left back as well, who would, I presumably, you know, he would go into number two on the depth chart there, and Thorarinson would go to number one. He was Matarita's backup last year. But, like, this is not enough for NYCFC. Like, this was a team within touching distance of, like, the very best in the league for a while. And if they don't do real work this offseason, it feels like that's gone in 2021. Now, it's not going to be, like, wooden spoon level, right? Yeah. It's not the same type of work that Cincinnati has to do, but it's still a lot of work. And I think that, you know, judging by what I see on Twitter and on fan blogs, like, NYCFC fans are not happy right now. They're waiting for something to happen, and it's been a long, long wait.
And so my pushback, because we talked about this before the meeting, and I've seen a lot of it on social media as well, is, you know, in that City Football Group that there are players who are available who will be on this team. Mm-hmm. We've seen it with Yangel Herrera, right? It was last minute with him every single time. We've already heard the rumors of some CFG players, whether they've been signed to the family yet or not. I understand your point, and I think Tati Castellanos being lost is, that is a guy who could play all three spots across that front three, which was their, that was their Swiss Army knife for any of those losses. Now you don't have that. So I get what you're saying, but there are teams, and I think about the Galaxy number one, potentially Toronto as well, who I don't know their best 11 right now. And it feels like NYCFC I do, where the Galaxy, who's in central midfield, who's their starting center backs, who's on the right wing. We think Pavone's coming back. That's your left wing. It feels like there are massive gaps in this team where you could be talking out of the playoffs, wooden spoon territory, where NYCFC is already above that.
You're right, except that they're so thin. And then if you think about the way this season is going to go, it's going to be, you know, Saturday, Wednesday, almost every week because the season's starting a little bit later and there are, you know, international dates and tournaments and everything. So you have a best 11. Every team in the league should be counting on having a best 25. Mm-hmm. Like, you are not going to get through this season in good shape if you can't go way, way down the depth chart and start getting answers. Now, maybe NYCFC had, like, they still have Tavon Gray, who's one of my favorite, you know, academy prospect. He didn't play at all last year. He could be an answer at right back and at defensive midfield. Obviously, James Sands coming back. Andres Jessen, the winger that they signed, a high upside kid. But it's not enough. There's still no replacement for Maxi. You know, and like there's still no depth behind Eber. And it's unclear if the Eber of 2019 was the real Eber in the first place. So you're right that other teams clearly have more to do. But it feels like the stuff, like, you only get so long to compete for a trophy, man. Like this NYCFC team has been so close.
Yeah.
And like, you, if you're this close, you have, you have to give it a big push. And it doesn't, like, I'm still waiting for that to happen.
It was sort of like the Red Bulls at the end
yeah.
of that run, which was the, it's either push or no, and it went the no way. And that's how it feels with NYCFC. So New York, City of Champions, Julius Randle, 40 points, put it in the banners. That's how we do it in this city. Goodness. Well, talking about transfers, obviously one has gone down. Alexandre Pato, the legendary Brazilian phenom from a long time ago. I watched him play in person in Montreal in 2007 in the U20 World Cup. They lost to Poland at Stade Olympique, and it was the most Polish I've ever felt, and I'm not even Polish. So it was a pretty good day, and now he plays for Orlando City, and so we had to talk to the person who knows the most about everything going on in Orlando, Julia Poe of the Orlando Sentinel, our AT&T 5G call to the field. All right, well, big news coming out of Orlando today, and who else to talk to but the number one beat reporter, not just in Orlando, but potentially the world's beat reporter right now, the Orlando Sentinel soccer writer, Julia Poe. Julia, thanks for joining us.
Thank you guys so much for having me on. I feel like you're overhyping me a little bit with that. I'm just lucky with the geography this year.
I don't think that there's a coincidence that you are in Orlando and every single soccer event that's occurred in the last 12 months has also happened in Orlando. But we'll get to that at the end.
Definitely.
We'll get to that. Let's start out with the big news. Alexandre Pato, he's a famous name. Maybe not at the time a lot of people thought he'd come to MLS, but it's an interesting move and one that's really fascinated, I think, a lot of people and definitely shown up around the world, one of those classic MLS moves. What's the details on this? What type of player do they expect to be getting? How big of a signing is this?
Yeah, it's interesting because I think maybe in past years, if you had said that someone like Pato was signing with Orlando City, you'd expect him coming in for a higher salary mark than we're seeing reported, you know, a longer extension than you're seeing reported. And really, this is a guy where Orlando City is kind of taking a low risk, potentially high reward move here out of a player who is still has a lot of time left in him. You know, he's a player who really blew up in his youth. So I think sometimes it feels like he's older than he is. He's only 31. You know, a lot of people have been remarking at the fact that he's still got a lot of legs left in him. And he's coming into a situation where, you know, he's going to be in a very hungry striker pool. So he's going to be positioned where he can be pushed. He's not going to be allowed to kind of rest and relax. And I don't think that that's what he wants. That's not what Orlando City wants. So it's really a guy with a lot of potential still left in him who's coming in and kind of getting to show that he can really push himself in this league. And we've seen him do that before in the past. He did really well in China when he was playing there for a couple seasons. So we know that he still has that left in him. It's just getting him in the position where he can be pushed to kind of take advantage of the situation that he's in. This seems like that might be a really good matchup for him.
So it will be wait and see, though, because it's not a guarantee that he's going to walk right into that number nine starting role. And it was the same with Daryl Dike last year, right? He had to earn it over time, and he obviously did earn it by playing some spectacular soccer in the second half of the season. And then the loan. And we saw him make his debut in England this past weekend. What is the expectation in Orlando about how this loan works out? Are they thinking that they maybe have seen the last of Daryl Dike in purple, at least for this iteration, and that he is on his way to a permanent move overseas?
It definitely seems like it's not structured for that permanent loan unless there is an opportunity to really get just the absolute biggest bang for the buck out of it. I don't think Orlando City wants to see Daryl Dike exit this quickly unless there is that payoff where everyone is benefiting at that level, both financially and in the opportunity that he's getting out to. Obviously, we see that with this reported price tag on this loan. That's not an easy price tag for a team like Barnsley to meet unless they're able to just fly up into promotion. So there's that understanding there with that. And I also feel like there is an understanding with this striker unit is very, very different. And Pato's situation is very, very different if Daryl does exit on a loan. You know, there's a very different understanding of what everyone's roles are going to be. And that competition that I was talking about before really changes a lot depending on whether Daryl stays or goes. So I think everything from the structure of the loan, everything even from just how you see Orlando City, you know, commenting on all of Barnsley's social accounts yeah. and that constant interaction, they're making it clear that, like, hey, this is still our guy. This is still, you know, our our dude, we're really, really invested in him. And I think that we're still seeing that investment. I would not be surprised to see him come back. And I do think that if they let him go, it's going to be for a pretty high price.
Just walk us through the particulars of the loan structure again for our listeners who might not have heard all of it.
Definitely. So it's a $20 million price tag on this short-term loan. So it's a short-term loan, which means that Orlando City can recall him at any point, but either way, it's going to expire at the end of the season in May. So not a super long time over there. The price tag at the end of the option to buy is $20 million, and that's only for 80% of his rights. So Orlando City would still hold on to 20%, and they would get to cash in 20% of whatever future sale occurred. So it's a really, really high price tag. Like I said before, you know, Orlando City really has not dealt like this with European clubs before, but after seeing the way that Daryl worked in that team last year, you can kind of see where he garnered that interest and that expectation there.
And from your point of view, is it him and his agent that pushed this? Is it the club seeing an opportunity? How does this move come about? Because I think for all of us on the outside, it felt like at the 11th hour, this kind of came out of nowhere.
Yeah, I don't really know the specifics on who pushed for that, what kind of that breakdown looked like. But I do think that it was a quick turnaround. It was something where Orlando City is always kind of shopping both ways. So it's not like they weren't looking. It's not like they weren't feeling offers. But this definitely was something where it was very quick moving, and they did need to turn it around really quickly. I think that's more reflective of where this club is at right now. They're trying to be a little bit more nimble. And Coach Oscar Pareja, Luis Muzzi, they've talked, especially post-pandemic, about the need to have that flexibility and that adaptability just to make things work in this market. You don't know who's going to even be able to get games off the ground on a week-to-week basis. So I think that it just came from that new feeling of adaptability that Orlando City has really gotten over the last probably 2-3 years as Muzzi has been moving and working more.
So in line with that, Chris Mueller breaking out in the national team, big year last year in MLS. And obviously the questions are going to come up. You see Jordan Morris go, Daryl Dike. The moves to Europe are always going to be talked about, or another league in general. Mueller's been in Orlando for a little while. Is this one of those adaptability moments? Do you see him being an Orlando player long-term?
You know, I think that first, Chris Mueller obviously is part of the DNA of this team right now. He's a very important part of what they're trying to do this upcoming season. But I do think there's that understanding that he has unlocked a level of potential that I'm not sure anyone outside of, you know, Chris and those really close to him were able to see just in the early years of his career. And if he keeps leveling up the way that he did last season, I don't doubt that we'll see him, you know, departing for something different in the future. I think that Orlando City would like to keep him here as long as they can. He's a really, really valuable asset, not just on the field, but in the locker room. You'll hear a lot of players talk about just who he is for this team. But no, I wouldn't be surprised to see him push himself for that. And I would not be surprised to see Orlando try to do exactly what they did with Daryl here, where they're putting themselves in a position that when and if he's ready to go, they can facilitate that and get the absolute most out of it.
And I imagine that applies to like Jegson Mendez and Andres Pereira and, you know, all on down the list for Orlando City. Are they, you know, we've heard the term selling team applied to the Union, to Dallas, and really to MLS as a whole in the past couple of years. It seems like Orlando City are trying to pretty rapidly go in that direction as well.
Well, and you're exactly right. It's interesting. I've spoken with the academy director before for Orlando City, who has talked about just the value that can be brought to this team if they can continue to have. I mean, you mentioned some guys that aren't academy members, but even looking at someone like Benji Michel, who has really made a lot of strides in his career, if this team can take him from an academy product to someone who eventually is able to depart and in return bring, you know, a big economic windfall, that would be huge for the club. And I know that that's something that they talk about a lot, is trying to find. Orlando City has gotten really good at finding these gems that they're not necessarily needing to drop a huge bag of money on to bring in. You look at Andres Pereja, for instance. And I do think that that model of, they want guys that are here and willing to stay. And you've seen that with Robin Johnson, Antonio Carlos. They've signed on for very long contracts. But when they find these young little gems, I think they're very willing to push them to their maximum here and then eventually be able to flip them and get that, that help and that boost for both sides that also benefits the players.
Now, you mentioned the academy director and Orlando, Central Florida, all of Florida really is hugely fertile ground for some of the best athletes in the entire world. Orlando City, though, have been kind of like hot and cold on their academy over the past 6 years, though. Sometimes it seems like they're super committed to it, and other times they're cutting back. Just this offseason, there was an announcement about the academy structure itself and some initiatives. Can you talk, walk us through that? And then just long term, is the idea to be Florida's version of FC Dallas?
Yeah, definitely. And I mean, you look at the FC Dallas comparison, look who's in charge of this Orlando City organization now. It's Muzy and Pareja, the same people that were helpful and, really vital in putting together that FC Dallas structure. And I think something that you'll hear across the boards is that the reinvestment has been really visible ever since Muzy came into the club. I remember when I spoke to David Loera, who is a homegrown kid that was signed last season, he talked about how he hadn't heard from Orlando City in a few years. He was at college and he got a call from Muzy within his first few weeks on the job being like, hey, we're trying to reconnect with our guys. We're trying to kind of get back in touch and in line with everyone. And there's been a very pointed focus on that. That was clear last year as well with bringing everything under the same roof. You've got the academy training in the same place that the senior team is. And then obviously the reinvestment this offseason. I mean, Oscar Pareja is out there being the coach who is facilitating tryouts for the academy teams for a couple of the age groups. So there definitely is that investment. There definitely is that focus. I think now it's how do you properly execute that? Because you can throw a lot of resources at it, but it's also figuring out how they can position the right people around these players to really push them and elevate them up into the first team. And we're seeing that more. There's a lot of homegrown players and academy products on this team, but really besides Benji Michel, we haven't seen a ton of them actually take that next step to being big producers for the team. And that's not to downplay what Benji does. Obviously that's really critical to the team, but it's just seeing the quantity of them being able to repeat that. That's kind of that next step that they're at, I think.
One of the things that I think we thought we'd talk about more, and obviously with the way the world is the last year, it kind of went away at times. But when hearing you talk about the initiatives and the push in the academy, I think about, and I forgot, Miami coming in and they're a second team in Florida. In that way or in any other ways, have you seen Miami's existence affect Orlando City internally or externally?
Yeah, I think it definitely has been, and it's interesting because I think externally for folks that aren't in Florida, it might seem like that just happened over the last year, but that presence has been there for a while. I mean, when I arrived that, because I only got here a couple years ago, that presence was here and palpable, and you could kind of feel just that understanding of when you've got an in-state rival and when you've got a state like Florida that has so much youth talent here, there's always going to be that battling of making sure that you're getting as many, of these young prospects in, and just also that rivalry. I mean, it kind of is a little bit of an edge on everything that I think both clubs do. I don't think it's like always front of mind for them, but it's definitely always, you're always thinking about it a little bit. It's like, I grew up in Kansas City and it's like the KU-Mizzou rivalry. They're not even in the same conference anymore, and they still think about each other constantly. So it's just that that constant understanding of that, and definitely at the youth level, it's always there.
Man, we cut Weeby's power, and he still got a KU reference. And now Anders is with the Mizzou in the group chat. So let's just finish with this. As I said at the beginning, you are the World's Beat reporter now. Everything happens in Orlando. MLS is back. CCL, men's national team, women's national team. Now She Believes Cup coming up as well. What's it like to be the World's Beat reporter and have everyone watching your coverage? And are you excited about this upcoming tournament?
Yeah, I'm extremely excited. She Believes was the last tournament that I covered before with the U.S. Women's National Team before everything shut down and kind of, went to hell last spring. And I'm definitely excited for it. I think especially in a year with this much question of whether we're even going to see an Olympics, whether we're going to get a lot of these international tournaments off the ground, it's exciting to just be at something where you've got, you know, Brazil and Canada and the US going at each other. So that's going to be a lot of fun this week. And it's been strange having everything here and having, you know, especially when we had MLS's back here and then we immediately, you know, have had basically every international tournament played on American ground has been here over the last year. It's been different, but I'm really grateful for it. And I'm really grateful for, you know, the creepy empty stadiums. It's very odd to cover a game in an empty stadium, but it's been really nice. And it's been a good highlight for this year for me, for sure.
I told, number you, one highlight. Told you the cat would show up, by the way. Say hi to your dog.
I don't have a pet. I just have Rodrigo Schlegel in my heart, and that's it. That's about all I can think about right now. But for everyone out there, how can they follow you? How can they keep up with your work?
Yeah, so I write for the Orlando Sentinel. Please check that out. And then you can follow me on Twitter at @byjuliapoe.
It's the best follow out there. She is the only one at every single
game.
It
all revolves around her.
It all revolves around. We're just waiting for Euros to call and say that they're going to do it in Orlando.
Yeah, right.
Some crazy guy in Florida is trying to bring the Olympics here. So you know what? If that comes here to Orlando, then you know that my power is just, it's just that strong.
There's only one constant, and that is everything that happens, Julia will be at. Julia, thanks so much for taking the time to join us. Keep up with her work. She's awesome, and appreciate it.
Thank you guys so much. Appreciate it.
So make sure to follow Julia Poe, as she said, on social, at the Orlando Sentinel as well. She's been, I think, the best beat writer, clearly, for Orlando specifically, but I mean, in the world.
She was the MVP for 2020.
Absolutely. CCL, men's women's national team, She Believes Cup coming up. So it's going to be awesome to follow her. We started her with Pato. I think it's interesting, one, that we started her with that because it's a big name, but it is a growth of MLS that it's not the only thing we have to talk about, mm-hmm. right? A name of this quality. And I think the way this move went down is the next stage of MLS, which is he's not the star they're building this team around. This is a big name Brazilian who's on a 1-year flyer for a reasonable deal, because Orlando, I think right now it's striker by committee. They've got four options in there who isn't Daryl DK, whether he comes back or not. And it feels like it's just whoever's hot gets the opportunity and everyone kind of has an equal shot.
Yeah. I imagine it's going to be like an open tryout in preseason. And if Pato is healthy enough and good enough, and the first one has always been a bigger question than the second one, then he's got a chance to make this contract look like one of the best contracts in MLS history. And this flyer that Orlando City's front office took on him work out great. But it's a huge question with him. Like, Pato from about, 2007 to 2011 or so was considered one of the best young talents in the world. And then through injuries and like a weirdly late growth spurt, he went from like 5'9" to 6 foot, and he just never quite moved the same.
It was the next Shevchenko. It felt like that was the move.
Yeah. And it just didn't work out for him. Now he still scored at a good clip in China. He was pretty effective as a sub, mostly for Sao Paulo, which is not a bad level. Mm-hmm. But this is not a, you know, blister the paint type of signing anymore. But if he, like, maybe he has like a Bradley Wright Phillips style career renaissance in him. And that would be a great story, because, you know, Daryl DK is a great story. And Carlos Vela is a great story. You know, in Joseph Martinez is a great story, but that type of story where a veteran who was once a world tier prospect, and BWP wasn't quite that level, but he was a well-regarded prospect, comes to MLS and finds his game again and finds a level of happiness and achievement. Those are great stories too. So it's going to be interesting to watch, but I will take the under. I do expect one of the younger kids to sort of follow in DK's footsteps and win that job this year.
Just so you know, the over-under line I set was 1.5 goals for Pato. So you took the under on that one.
Oh, I expected it to be around 25 or something.
If you're going to take the under before I set the line, then I can set the line wherever I want. And that is the secret, my friends. But I think I agree with you. If he hits – now, the one thing positive is, while he hasn't played, you know, China's not the highest level. And then at Sao Paulo, as you said, wasn't a pure starter. he has been somewhat healthy over these 4 or 5 years. And so that's a positive. And as we've said, they've got Tesho. They signed Matias Arias already, who they believed could be a starting center forward. They have DK. I still think there is an interest in could Benji Michel play there for a certain set of minutes. And so, again, as Julia said, there's pressure to push Pato. But at the same time, for Orlando, there's no pressure that he has to hit because they have all these pieces. And it's really the one hole in this team, because we went into this interview to talk to Julia and it felt like there wasn't a lot of question marks for this group. The question marks where does this club stand? How did these young players, you know, how are they dealt with going forward? The academy, all that stuff, which is rare for Orlando in the past. So that's nice to know. And it was interesting to hear Julia talk about them being nimble, because that's one of the things we've seen positive in MLS.
For sure. And that front office has done a really good job of sort of cultivating that and having all these different acquisition methods and using them is an indication that they're serious about it. The one thing we didn't ask her about that we should probably have her back sometime in the next 2 months before the season kicks off is the other hole might be left back. With João Moutinho, they were a very different team without him in the second half of the year, much more counterattacking. And, you know, they have made a signing there, but how that ends up looking come April and May, I think will determine how Orlando City play, because they weren't able to be a possession team without João Moutinho at left back. They became almost a pure counterattacking team in the second half of the year. Something else to think about for Orlando City fans.
Yeah, and the hope is he'll be back by May or June, which you can understand. Jonathan Suarez, they brought on loan, American, so doesn't take up an international spot. Feels like Kyle Smith has given them some minutes there as well. But, of course, Kamal Miller started there in the playoffs. He's no longer part of this team. So it will be interesting to see that depth for Orlando. Let's move into some other moves. In MLS, it sounds like Atlanta has sent Eric Rometty to the San Jose Earthquakes. They were going to be one of my teams that had holes to fill because San Jose doesn't really sign players. Yeah. They got one in league in Rometty. He's a TAM guy. We know what he's done at Atlanta the year they won Cup. Obviously didn't really get much playing time over the last 18 months, really, under Frank DeBoer. Do you see this as the move for him to fit cleaner and kind of maybe come back in San Jose?
I mean, Matias Almeida gets a lot out of players who you wouldn't necessarily think that there's a lot there, right? And with Rometty, you actually, like, we've seen him be successful in MLS in the past. He was not one of the best D-mids in the league under Tata Martino, but he was really useful for a title-winning team. If he plays with energy, he didn't play with much energy the last 2 years under Frank DeBoer, and that is something, like, if he doesn't play with energy under Matias Almeida, he's not going to get on the field. So it's like it could fit really, really well, because in theory, he can take minutes from Jackson Ewell as something of a regista, and he could take minutes from Judson as something of a destroyer, because he has pretty good defensive range. The thing with him is energy and turnovers. If he's out there and he's into it, you know that you're going to get that kind of field coverage and ball winning. And can he sort of dial back his yellow instincts? Because at times it's just like, what are you doing, man? Why are you going down that blind alley? What are you doing hitting that pass? Because
that's normally how players under Matias Almeida scale back their game.
Right.
By covering every blade of grass and then not fouling.
But I think, honestly, I think putting him in a situation where he has to be constantly alert and alive to the danger and the opportunity might be the perfect situation for this guy, because there is talent there. And one note, our good friend Alicia Rodriguez pointed this one out on Twitter. This is only the second time in Jesse Fiorinelli's, I think, 5 years now as a GM, that he has executed an interleague trade for a player. The first one was like Dama Duro for Quincy Ameriqua, which was like way down the depth chart, I think 3 or 4 years ago. Is it this, like, I mean, I don't know. I don't know what it means for San Jose, whether they're becoming more willing to start to use all of the player acquisition methods at their disposal, but it's like the fact that this is only the second time ever, and that they did give up a good chunk of allocation money potentially for this guy, whose salary is not particularly small. I think that does tell you that they see something there. And we all know that when it comes to player acquisition in San Jose, what Matias wants, Matias gets. So this has got to be an Almeida guy.
And it's an Argentine defensive midfielder, right? So you have that connection. And I agree with you. I think the first thought in my head is the lack of energy, and I think that's a good word to use for it, had in my head converted over to he doesn't cover a lot of ground. Because it hadn't felt like he's done that in 2 years. And you finished with Nagby, who did so much of that for him. And then he basically hasn't played. So there's still that question mark of what he is and what he can be. It isn't actually that much. It's the reports are it's $200,000 in allocation money guaranteed with $300,000 potential based on results. $200,000 allocation is less than Julio Cascante.
Yeah.
For a guy who's a TAM player who started. So it's a smart move from San Jose in identifying a player that a team didn't want and getting him off their books. And it is fascinating that they haven't. But, you know, there aren't a lot of interleague trades you can make with Chivas. It's tough to kind of get that allocation money to Chivas in that way. So that might be one of the things that stood in their way, I think, for San Jose.
This is a Banfield guy, though. This guy goes, you know, before the Chivas days for,
absolutely.
For Almeida.
And I think for San Jose fans, they appreciate seeing a player come in the door because outside of La Chofis, I don't think they've made a single permanent move this offseason. So it helps to just get that depth you'd expect, as we'll talk about in a little bit, Jackson Ewell to be with some national team for some part of this year. And so hopefully there'll be minutes to fill there. A few quick hitters, and then we'll get into the national team. Reports coming out, I think, by Ivis that Kamar Lawrence is interested in potentially coming back to MLS from Anderlecht. Because my understanding is because he was sold by the New York Red Bulls, but he's also eligible to be a free agent in MLS. He's actually available to go anywhere and doesn't have to come back through an allocation order. And no one has to acquire his rights from the Red Bulls. Then the question would be with Anderlecht, what do you want to do? He had struggled, but my understanding is he's now kind of solidified that left back spot. So it'll be interesting because we know in MLS how good he can be. And so there are pretty much every team that needs a left back. Speaking of fullbacks, Kieran Gibbs is rumored to be, I don't know, contacted by teams. This feels a little iffy to me, but he will be a free agent this summer. Columbus picked up an international or gave up an international spot to Orlando, which they needed because they were over their limit for a bunch of allocation money. Eric Hurtado headed to bringing Hurtado Island to CF Montreal again. I think
Montreal is an island. Montreal is an island, right? Ile de Montreal.
Is it an island?
Yeah, it's right in the middle. It's an island in the middle of the St. Lawrence River. I thought you were Canadian.
So I'm basically from Montreal.
Okay.
I'm Quebecois. But I thought that it only had a river alongside it. I didn't realize it was an actual island.
No, Ile de Montreal.
Nice. Okay. Yeah. Mont Royal, which is what Montreal's named after. I knew that one. O'Neill Fisher signing with the LA Galaxy makes sense. That's an MLS caliber depth piece at right back. Oscar Boniac Garcia, the legend, returning to the Houston Dynamo. They also re-signed Maynor Figueroa. So in about 2028, I think that's when they're going to cycle those two out from their starting lineup. And now let's get into some little mailbag with some little European, American, and Canadian coverage. The States FC says, will an American win UEFA Champions League this year? Of course, Champions League kicking off in like a couple hours while we're recording. Doyle, do you have a positive or a negative answer to that?
I think there's a better chance than any year in the past, right? If you look at the way Manchester City are playing, like they have been lights out for months and months now. Of course, Pep has been known to galaxy brain a lineup or two in big games, especially late in the Champions League. So I struggle calling them the favorites, but you know, Stefan's got a real shot. I don't think Leipzig are playing well enough. I don't think Juve are playing well enough. Joe Scally for Borussia Mönchengladbach. He's not on the roster. He's not officially on the roster, so I'm not sure if he counts.
But if Pep Galaxy brains it enough, then they could be going through on that one. But you can't count out a Juve, right?
Right.
They've got, I think, Porto in the round of 16. They could move on from there. So, and then Chelsea as well with Christian Pulisic potentially getting opportunity there. I don't know if Chris Richards would get a Bayern Munich medal if he's on loan. I assume you would, right?
Yeah, he played two or three games in the actual Champions League. So
he's, oh, and I Sorry, Anders put in here because I forgot that the U.S. national team is the greatest team in the world. Serginho Dest.
Serginho Dest. So I was waiting on that one because I just, like, Barcelona, I can't see it. I mean, unless Messi somehow has yet another level, I can't see it happening with Barcelona, and I can't see it happening with Borussia Dortmund with the way they're playing. Dortmund's been a disaster for...
They can't defend. So maybe they should go get Chris Richards, but they can't defend. Barcelona feels more likely because they've actually been okay the last few weeks. Mm-hmm. Like the attack's gotten coherent. But I think the exciting part is how many names we just potentially actually...
It is. But all right. So of that list of names, which was longer than it's ever been in the past, we both agree that Stefan has the best chance to get a medal. So who do we think is next?
So I would say this. How about this? The person who I think has the most potential to play in a Champions League final, because I don't know that Stefan would play, I think is McKennie. Even as bad as Juve has been at times, mm-hmm. one, you know he'd play if they got there. And they are still fairly solid defensively. They have Ronaldo. And sometimes when Cuadrado's playing and they're in Chiesa, they can be dangerous on the counterattack.
Yeah.
So that would be the one I would say.
Yeah, because they are still dangerous on the counter and they're still dangerous on set pieces. And if you can do that, then you could go pretty far in tournament play. So I think I agree with that. McKennie is the one who's likeliest to actually play if, you know, in the Champions League final. Leipzig have been ugly recently, don't you think? Like, there's just something not clicking for them.
Yeah, it's been less fluid the last few weeks, and it felt like they'd lost the title race that they were in. Mm-hmm. Although with Bayern dropping points this weekend, they're only 5 points back on equal games, so they could be back in it. I would agree with you at the same time. They seem like a team that gets up for these European games and has, at when they've been playing poorly, kind of clicked in European competition. Obviously, the goal scorer, Angelino, anytime you got a guy like that going for one. We probably have to mention the most likely former MLSer to play in a Champions League final is Alphonso Davies, who scored 100%. A banger this week to tie that up 3-3, clean off the volley, won the Club World Cup. This is our everything. Alphonso Davies is the shining light that we carry above us. And to all my fellow Quebecois and everyone in Canada, first of all, happy Families Day, because yesterday was a holiday in Canada. It's called Family Day. I don't know what it's for. I don't know what you do. Sounds nice. And we are very proud of Alphonso Davies and what he's done. I wanted to swing in one more European convo, which is, we mentioned Borussia Mönchengladbach a few times. Mm-hmm. Came out in a very funny way. Borussia Mönchengladbach announced that Marco Rose, their coach, will take over Dortmund next year. Dortmund did not say this. Gladbach did. It didn't seem like they were super excited about that. And the rumors have already started about who will replace Rose. Mark Van Bommel's been mentioned. Erik ten Hag, who's sort of turned it down from Ajax, has been mentioned. And then three Red Bull family guys. You have Adi Hütter, who's at Eintracht Frankfurt, former Salzburg coach. And then a young man named Jesse Marsch, who's the current coach of Red Bull Salzburg. If you don't know, Marco Reus was a Salzburg head coach.
Marco Reus.
I keep saying Royce because he's going to Dortmund. He's killing me. And then he took over at Gladbach. Let's not talk about if this happens, because who knows? But it's pretty cool to have a former MLS player, coach, and U.S. national team guy potentially be a head coach of a Champions League Bundesliga side.
Yeah. Do you think Jesse will come back on extra time if he gets the job?
No. Last time he came on, he said something about Pulisic. Lampard got upset. So we're already in the doghouse. And if you ever want to watch a Red Bull Salzburg game, Mr. Ben Baer, friend of the show, legend of the show, is currently doing commentary for them somewhere on Twitter. So follow him on Twitter. You can find those games. I don't even know how to find them, but sometimes they come up. And it's pretty funny because Ben gets to do his thing. And, of course, Brendan Aaronson scored last week, and their team's been rolling. Marco Rose, I think, set a record. I think in 3 years as a head coach, he didn't lose a single home game for Salzburg. Jesse hasn't been that good, but they were really competitive in Champions League. He has ideas of how he wants them to play. Seems to be a clean fit for what Gladbach's done in the past.
It seems like Jesse Marsch is destined to get a managerial job in the Bundesliga. The question is, will it be with a team like Mönchengladbach, who are consistently like top 6-7 in the league, or will he stay in the Red Bull family? Because Nagelsmann probably isn't going to be at Leipzig forever. And I imagine that's a source of constant discussion amongst Jesse and the other folks in the Red Bull family. Either way, it's exciting, man. He's one of several coaches, American coaches over there breaking new ground. We'll see what that means for him long term. But I do expect him to make a pretty big move at some point.
It's very simple. Tuchel leaves, Nagelsmann goes to Chelsea, Jesse goes to Leipzig, and a Champions League final. Christian Pulisic against Tyler Adams and Jesse Marsh. You're welcome, Disney. I wrote you your next goal movie, and Santiago Muniz can also be in it if you want to. Let's break into these national team rosters a little bit, because Doyle, you put out two pieces last week for your depth chart, and we were going to do it on Thursday. We didn't get enough time because MLS keeps rolling along. And you dug into basically the depth at every position across the national team and where these rosters stand. Coming out of it, what was your like feeling? Obviously, we talk about this a lot, but I always know when you dig into a piece and you get your mind wrapped around it, you kind of walk away with an emotion about what the subject is. What was your feeling?
I'm pretty confident, to be honest with you. And that comes from both the system that Berhalter has installed, which I think is has evolved over the last 2 years into something both attractive and idealistic, but pragmatic at the same time. Like we have the horses to really, really press teams and ruin their days. Mm-hmm. And in 2019, he wasn't really unleashing that. Well, in 2020 and 2021, every time we took the field, we were just stepping on teams' throats. Other than the European based group struggled against Wales a little bit, but that's fine. That was the first time they played together.
And mud doesn't count.
And mud
doesn't. Games on grass only.
Right. So I'm super confident. Part of it comes from that system. Part of it comes from just the depth. It's insane. Like I think back to the 2019 U20 World Cup team, which is, for my money, the best U20 World Cup team the U.S. has ever had. And like three of my favorite players from that group.
2007, Stade Olympique, Michael Bradley, Jozy Altidore, Freddie Adu.
That's in the argument. And the 1989 one is in the argument as well. But I think that the 2019 one is the one. And like three of my favorite players from that team were Paxton Pomykal, Richie Ledesma, and Tim Weah. And those three guys have spent most of the past 2 years hurt. And it hasn't dinged the U.S.'s depth chart almost at all. And like in the past, if we had a great young player who got hurt, like that was a catastrophe. That was, oh my, like we don't have a way of replacing this. And it's just not the case anymore. And it's happened so rapidly, like over the past half decade, as the very worst thing in U.S. soccer in U.S. men's soccer was happening by missing the World Cup. At the same time, this new generation of young players was coming up, where you had Pulisic level and McKennie level stars, but you also had so many guys who were a level beyond just pretty good coming up behind that. So there's not as much week to week tension. Like Pulisic's on the bench now.
Yeah.
And I'm not saying I don't care, but I'm not worried about it. So that is a big thing. And taken in context of what World Cup qualifying is this time around, that's huge, because there's been tons of arguments about what's our best 11. We're not going to use a best 11. The games are like three games a window. There's only 2 days between those games. Like you are not going to see the same players out there for the U.S. national team game after game after game during qualifying. You're going to have to go, I assume it'll be a 23-man roster for qualifiers for FIFA windows. You're going to have to use all 23 of those guys. There is going to be more and heavier rotation this cycle than we've ever had in the past. And in the past, I think that would have really hamstrung the U.S. In this cycle, it actually plays to our benefit, because we have so many answers basically everywhere.
So you mentioned those, three game windows. When Berhalter came on the show, he talked about Nations League final. which they hope will be two games and maybe is guaranteed. I don't know if there's a third place match. He said, we're setting up a friendly right after that to recreate these three windows, because he knows, as you're saying, and I think it's going to be similar to what we saw under Bruce Arena when he had the, I think it was home Panama and San Jose. And then we went to the Azteca where he basically, we found out after, had two 11s in training, and they were playing and training for two different games. And so that second Mexico game, I think Kellen Acosta got the start, Omar Gonzalez, a whole different group in a different formation, and they got the result there. I look at this pool, and it's interesting. You say depth at center forward and at left back, which are the two question marks. There's depth. No one's established themselves. So it's kind of like a double-edged sword, right? You have options, which is great, but it's also you don't know who's there because no one's locked themselves in. Do either of those spots worry you?
I mean, I'm not as confident about those spots as I am about other spots. And just to contextualize it, we're saying nobody has established himself. Like, Jossie Zardes, when he plays center forward for the U.S. national team, scores a goal about, you know, every 200 minutes, which is not groundbreaking, but it's like a higher goal-scoring rate than Brian Ching or Eddie Johnson had at center forward. So, like, that's a guy who's not established in this new sort of paradigm of, like, Josh Sargent is an every game starter in the Bundesliga. He's not necessarily a starter for the U.S. national team, and there are good reasons for that. But in the past, if we had a guy starting in the Bundesliga, it would have been like, get him onto the field in pen. And you just go down the list at striker. Like, Daryl Dike had such a great rookie year that now there's, you know, alone with a team chasing promotion and perhaps an eight-figure transfer fee out. Ayo Akinola had an even better year than DK in terms of goal scoring. We saw what Matthew Hoppe did. Nico Joachini scored a brace on his U.S. national team debut, and so did Sebastian Soto. And we see, you know, how well Jesus... So, like, I understand that a lot of these guys are more prospect and potential and production at this point. But one of them's going to hit. David.
Let me ask you about two. One is Tim Weah, who you brought up from the U-20s, who's gotten himself back into the Lille team, sometimes at forward, sometimes on the wing. And then Jordan Morris, who now got his first start, I think a week ago for Swansea, in that 3-5-2, playing in those two forwards as well. What do you make of those two players? And are those two players that if they perform at the club level at center forward or quote unquote forward position, do they move into that convo?
For number nine?
Yeah.
They could. I don't necessarily see it with Morris because he just can't do the work with his back to goal that Berhalter has pretty consistently asked of his center forwards. Even Jossie, who's not great with his back to goal, can complete the next pass. Weah can't actually do that. And Weah,
no, he can't. The buzzer, right. FedEx says no, yeah, right? He can't.
Weah can actually do that. And Weah is, you know, one of my favorite players because he's so smart off the ball. You put him in any attacking position and he just immediately figures it out.
And your depth spot, you have him as your starting right mid, right attacker, right?
So I think if it happened right now and we absolutely had to play our best 11, then I think it would probably be Pulisic on the left and Morris on the right. But I think that Weah has a higher ceiling than Morris. And if he gets six more months of health and high level reps, I kind of expect Tim Weah to pass Jordan Morris on that. I love Tim Weah. I just think, I think we have a lot of guys on this roster who can solve problem with their technique. And that's great. And solve problems with their passing. And that's great. And I think that the system that we're using creates problems in terms of positional play for the other team. Weah solves problems for the U.S. and creates solves problems for Lille. But I think this would translate to the U.S. and creates problems for the opposition with his off the ball movement. He's just so smart. And he always understands how to create that space. And if he's playing right wing and he's going, like, that will either, like, if he darts inside, that creates out, you know, cuts out a defender and drags a defender with him and creates space on the overlap for Serginho Dest. Or, you know, or if he checks back, then that would allow the right-sided free eight to go forward, and that's either, you know, McKennie or Legette or Aaronson and guys who have shown the ability to understand those sort of things. I really like Tim Wyatt. I'm very happy that he's healthy, and I hope he stays healthy. But the thing is, like, that's like best 11 doesn't even matter at this point. It is best 23 or even 30, and we're lucky at this point to have Pulisic and Morris and Wea and Gio Reyna, and Jonathan Lewis was awesome last week. Mm-hmm. Paul Areola, or last month rather, Paul Areola has been great since coming back from his ACL, and we have answers in our depth, whereas in the past we primarily just had questions. And that includes, by the way, that includes left back. Like, yeah. I'm not a huge Anthony Robinson fan, but Anthony Robinson's pretty much a Premier League starter. Mm-hmm. Sam Vines is fantastic. Sergiño Dest can play left back, and in fact did play left back in his last US appearance. George Bello, I think we all saw the improvement that he had for Atlanta United in the second half of the season, and we all know what his ceiling is. So it's just it's a different era. It's just a vastly different era than what we've had in the past for the US.
And we don't even know about Yunus Musa, who starts for Valencia and obviously start in that Wales midfield, in the midfield against Wales, and could be another piece that does that push Reyna wide? Does that give you more options? Whatever it does, it's not a negative to have guys like that. It's pretty interesting. Check out Matt Doyle's piece. So you've got the U23s coming out this week. Is there anything that sticks out in your mind about that?
So this is different because I'm doing the U23 depth chart for Olympic qualifying. Mm-hmm. And all those guys, all those European-based guys we just talked about, none of them are going to be released. Like, we're not going to have Pulisic. We're not going to have Sargent. We're not going to have Reyna. We're not going to have Hoppy. We're not going to have Tyler Adams or Weston McKennie. All these guys are Olympic age eligible, but teams are not under any obligation to release players for youth tournaments. And that's what this technically is. Olympic qualifying is a youth tournament. MLS teams almost always play nice with that. MLS teams almost always release guys for these things. So this depth chart I'm doing is primarily MLS based. A couple of guys like Johnny Cardozo, who's down with Internacional in Porto Alegre. Who else? Chris Gloucester, who hasn't found a team since being released by PSV. But Bofo? I don't think he wants to go by Bofo anymore.
Oh, Salcedo?
Sebastian Salcedo. So I'm on the fence with him. I'm not sure Pumas will release him, because what does it benefit them to release and they're one of the big clubs in Mexico. It doesn't really benefit them to release a player who's in their rotation and release him to the U.S. national team. Or
the question is, in Mexico, the tournament's in Guadalajara. If he goes and he kills it and even beats Mexico head to head, does that increase his value? Is that a guy that you can move somewhere with that? That would be the only thing, because I agree with you. He's a piece of that team. He's also on the older edge of this. So it's not like you're looking at a 10-year layout and say, well, at 19, let's get him here so that we could sell him to Europe in 2 or 3 years. But he's eligible, so I figured I'd throw it out there.
No, like I'm on the edge with him. Even limiting the scope of who we could possibly call in as much as I did, our starting 11 for this would be Jonathan Lewis, who just scored a brace for the national team, Ayo Akinola, who, you know, we know what he did with Toronto and with the national team last year. Benji Michel at right wing is maybe a little bit questionable because we haven't seen him yet. But then it's like, Eric Williamson was one of the best midfielders in the league last year. I would have him starting in central midfield. If Pomacall can go, he starts. If not, it's Tanner Tessman. You know, Jackson Ewell, who has been a regular for the national team and excellent for Santa. He's the D-mid. Sam Vines, Miles Robinson, maybe Henry Kessler, maybe Abubakar Keita, maybe Mauricio Pineda at center back. And right back, Aaron Herrera, Julian Arujo. Like, we just saw Reggie Cannon, Sergiño Dest, Brian Reynolds all go to Europe, to like two of them to legitimately big teams on big fees. All three of those guys are eligible for this Olympic team. None of the three will be released. And right back is still like a really strong position for us. us. And I just hope that the fans who have kind of suffered over the last 10 years are taking a minute to appreciate the growth that we've seen.
Anyone who watched Sean Johnson run into that post in Olympic qualifying in 2008 gets to enjoy this. So I was coming to a good point. It was going to come back around. Enjoy this. It would be interesting if they do qualify. The other pieces, I think of like an Eric Palmer Brown, an Uli Lainez, those guys who there could be value in going to an Olympics. They don't have to be released. Where they fit back into this pool if you have a good qualifying run. So that could be interesting going forward.
I think with Giannis, who's still only 19, by the way, if he gets released, which is not out of the question, given that he has had a very unsuccessful loan at Eredivisie, and that Wolfsburg have actually played really nice with the U.S. national team when it comes to him and Brian Keo. If he is released for Olympic qualifying, I could see him ending up in a starting role. But at this point, it does feel like he's had a wasted year of non-development since he made his U.S. debut last winter against Costa Rica and played, I thought, pretty well.
Before he ever played a pro soccer game.
Yeah, right.
Which is always the direction you want to go in and always interesting. So keep your eyes out for that on MLSsoccer.com. Obviously, send us all your thoughts and questions because we just enjoy doing this and it's pretty fun to do right now. And there's a lot to watch and a lot to follow. Speaking of national team, let's talk national team legends for a second as we head to the mailbag. We got a lot of Tony Sane love off that interview from last week. I think it's the best interview we've done in at least a year because I can't remember past a year ago because the world is endless. But it was awesome to talk to him. We could have done it for 6 hours. We almost did. We probably will have him on again to try and do that if we ever get Weeby internet or electricity, which means if I allow it. But it was so much fun. Doyle, I know he's a guy that you've been a fan of for years as a player and a person. I'd never spoken with him before. And so we got a bunch of mail that basically sounded like this. Tony Sane. And a lot of that. A lot of energy. So I was into that. And on that note, we also wanted to add a fan, Ryan Tabley, on Twitter, who says, if FC Cincinnati gets a competent 10, PT Lucho or someone else, so they have a shot at playoffs with that new stadium hype.
I mean, it's MLS, so anything can happen. We've seen worst to first turnarounds in the past. And I also, but I think we talked about it on the show last week. Like, I'm not sure that PT or Lucho really checks the box as a competent number 10, right? Like both guys are so hit and miss, and Cincinnati can't have a guy who's hit and miss. They need a guy who can go out there every week and be, you know, what Maxi Morales has been to NYCFC or what Ladero is to Seattle. Like eventually every team runs out of ideas, and that's when you need that guy who, okay, we're just going to give the ball to him and he's going to figure everything out for us and at least recycle possession and recycle, you know, some sort of semblance of cohesion. And I don't think either guys mentioned in that tweet are the type of guys who do that.
So as time melts, so I don't know when this happened and what we've actually talked about. I believe after the show was when the Frankie Amaya news came out, reported by Paul Tenorio, so you know it's real, not Sam, that he's asking for a trade from FC Cincinnati. Doyle, what's your reaction to that, of what that means for Cincinnati? And then what are the names that flash in your head? We know that two or three teams had offered big chunks for him, and they had turned them down, of where he should land, who should try and land him.
I think Cincinnati should try to keep him. I think Amaya is like, he's been the only good thing by some measures about this team in their first 2 years, and I understand his frustration. $1 million in allocation money is a lot to turn down, and it sounds like it was a seven-figure potential trade, but I understand why they didn't do it, because Amaya is a sure thing. If he's fit and you get him out there as a sort of a destroying number eight, or even continue to develop him as a number six, he's a guy with a national team upside and you know, sell on to a big club overseas for $5 or $6 million type of upside. But it comes back to FC Cincinnati having the ability to get that out of players, and they haven't really shown it yet.
Which I think is why you see a young player who's on that line of, He wasn't a first name mentioned in your Olympic qualifying, and he was a starter for that U20 qualifying. And he's not, you know, the first player that's been in some of these national team camps going down the depth chart. You can see why for him, he wants something more stable going forward. But the money that Cincinnati spent, I mean, he's got more quality in front of him already in Brenner than he's had. Some of the names that popped in my head, first of all, any team? Come on, Doyle.
I'm not gonna say sight unseen that Brenner is more quality than, well, anyway, continue.
He's more, all right, fine. I'm not even going to get into this Brandon Vasquez conversation that you're pushing at me right now. But I thought Houston was one team that made sense. They have allocation money to spend with the Minotas thing. They've got space in their midfield. That could be an option for a player like him. Maybe LA Galaxy? Mm-hmm. Put him alongside Jonah and have them both just kind of do everything. But could be interesting to see where he falls. And on that note, we've got one to close out on. We've got a question here. It says, first time, long time, is Kobe Jones the most underrated Galaxy player of all time? I'll hang up and listen. That came from at PJ Wes, who grew up on North Bayless alongside your own David Goss, one of my oldest friends. Definitely doesn't listen to this show, so we'll never hear this answer. So you don't even have to give it unless you really want to, Doyle.
No. I think Cienfuegos is the most underrated Galaxy player of all time. He was not quite Echeverry Valderrama Preki level in the early days, but like a half tier down from that. And just like a joy to watch. I loved that guy. So the answer is no. Kobe Jones is not the most underrated Galaxy player.
Boom. There you go. The truth from Matt Doyle. You can catch his articles on MLSsoccer.com going forward. We'll be back on Thursday as usual. You can watch the show on YouTube. Download wherever you download. I may allow power back to Andrew and he will be back. If not, it'll be from New York, New York, which you know is number one. Thanks so much for listening and watching, everyone. Have a great day.